Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Tell me what kind of man Jesus is. Well, he spoke to the sick, and the sick got well, y'all. Tell me what kind of man Jesus is. Oh.
Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others, Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." He asked them, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of the Creator with the holy angels."
Walk with me, Lord.
Last Sunday, we began a new year of children's ministries here at The Table, and there were 16 teachers that we blessed here to send out to watch over our children in love this school year, and some of our kids are here today for the first time. They missed last Sunday, and so they're making their way right now to sit in a circle together in godly play or upstairs in the middle. And last weekend, Linda and I shared together in teaching. I think we had 8 people in a Growing in Faith retreat. And Growing in Faith is one of the ways that we introduce people to each other and to our community here, and we're starting a group tonight, and there'll be another retreat that we'll do this winter. And as we were doing that, one of the people in our group is a parent, and this person was describing that their child is going to go for the very first time from the nursery into godly play. And this is a big transition, at least for that child. And in our family, our daughter was going from godly play upstairs, also a big transition. And initially, she was anxious about this. And then she told me afterwards, oh, Daddy, I'm going back for in the middle. So she has full on made the transition, not looking back, is ready to go. But as I was sharing with this parent and we're processing like what it's like to accompany our children as they go through these big shifts in their little lives, I was reminded of the question that our children are greeted with every Sunday morning as they make their way from this sanctuary into their godly play sanctuary. And right now, a high school student is sitting in a chair at the threshold of that children's sanctuary. His name is Jacob, and Jacob is welcoming each of those children as they come in, and he's got his hands out, and he's saying, are you feeling ready for godly play? Are you feeling ready for godly play? It's this opportunity for the child to slow down, kind of like as you come into this space and you hear the music that's playing and you see the stained glass and you slow down and you pause for a moment. You cross that threshold. It's an opportunity for that child to take a breath and to notice how their little body is, to make sure they're ready to open up, to hear the stories of our tradition and to learn some of the language of faith and to wonder about the mystery of God. And I imagine four-year-olds going in that space for the first time in a lot of different ways. Like one four-year-old might be going across that threshold right now as we're here in this space, hearing that big question, are you feeling ready? Thinking, well, I haven't ever done godly play before, so I don't know if I'm ready. That would be like a legit approach for a four-year-old going into that space. Or some of our children have been processing this transition with their families, and so they might be thinking, like, just nod and think, I hope so. Like, I hope I'm ready to go into that. I can also imagine a child absolutely confident. Are you feeling ready? Absolutely, I am ready. And not having any idea what they're getting into. When they're saying, yes, I'm ready, we're still imagining the play area that we have in the nursery. They still have their toys with them in their pockets, and they're absolutely ready for godly play. They've got their toys, and they're ready to sit down and play with whatever they want to play with. So heck yes, we're ready to come into that space. Lots of our children have never experienced anything quite like godly play before. Some of our kids have never had an adult share a story from Scripture and then wonder with them about what's going on. Some have never been invited to slow down and to hear the stories of our tradition. Some last week were experiencing for the very first time the story of creation from Genesis 1. Or are experiencing the very first time this morning this story that Godly Play calls the Holy Family. Some are going to share a feast, crackers and juice, in a way that they've never experienced before. So are they ready? Well, we hope that the children in our community who are gathering in that Godly Play circle for the first time might be moving in their young little lives toward a tipping point. By practicing their faith with other kids around their age, wondering about the love of God and the good news of our Christian faith. And I wonder if what seems like a tipping point for those 4 or 5-year-olds might be a tipping point actually for their whole family. Not just their little journey, but their whole family. Maybe even for our whole community. And maybe even for the world. The followers of Jesus experienced that kind of tipping point in the reading that Pastor Linda shared that's being read throughout the Global Christian Church this morning from Mark 8. Instead of asking his followers if they're ready, Jesus wonders what people around them are saying about him. That's the question that he asks. See, Jesus and his followers, if we were here last week, they've made their way from beyond the wall in Tyre back into their fringe of their homeland. They're back home in this space in the northern fringe of Galilee. And Jesus asked those that are following him, what are people saying about me? Are they getting the message? And they start to respond. And one biblical scholar says it this way. In a culture where one's identity and vocation were defined by the community's perception rather than by an individual's existential discernment. So like today, we think of like who we are as I'm thinking of who I am. In this day, people were identified by what others perceived them. Like, this is the son of, the daughter of, the child of. Those were ways. So he's trying to flesh out, what are people saying about who I am? So this question of who do people say I am would be an appropriate vehicle for this next step in Jesus' ministry. And clearly the responses of his followers put him in line with the prophets who've gone before him. That makes sense. Having heard how others perceive him, Jesus then asks the more pointed question, so who do you say that I am? And then it gets more challenging to answer for most of us, right? It's easier for me to say, well, this is what other people are saying about you, Amy. But Amy says, well, what do you say about me? Oh, this is a harder question. Well, it's not hard for Peter. Peter jumps in. He's usually the first one to answer, and he does in this case, and he says, you're the Messiah. On this side of resurrection, we know right answer. Like, way to go, Peter. Think about the child that's crossing the threshold into godly play for the first time. Like, are you feeling ready? The child pauses and says, yes, I am ready. Our godly play teachers are supposed to affirm them, right? They're supposed to celebrate that. That's what we hope is happening. Little Jacob is like, yes, you're ready. We're going to change the world together. That's what happens actually in Matthew's version of this story, in Matthew 16. That's the kind of godly play teacher that Jesus is with them. He's like celebrating, like, yes, Peter gets the right answer. So he stays with them. In Matthew 16, it says, Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Again, like referencing who he is. Based on his lineage. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Creator in heaven, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. See, Jesus in Matthew's gospel is like that phenomenal kindergarten teacher that we all wanted to have, that is like, yes, you've got this. We are in this together. This is beautiful. Mark's Jesus, not so much. This is less like phenomenal kindergarten teacher and more like what some of us have become accustomed to. I'd say like the tone of this is more like Coach Bill Belichick on Sunday morning in the NFL. Like that's Jesus' tone. It's not this celebratory kindergarten teacher. In this, in Mark's Jesus, like Peter confesses this. Jesus is the Messiah. That's the Hebrew, or Christ. That's the Greek. And Jesus immediately commands them to tell no one, and then he harshly predicts everything that's going to happen, and then he identifies Peter with Satan and says, get behind me. That's like a Bill Belichick kind of a move. Like, that is not like, yes, we are in this together. It's not, I hope, please, how our godly play teachers are accompanying our little 4 and 5-year-olds. So what is happening in Mark's gospel? Like, what is actually going on that has Jesus so upset with Peter giving him the right answer? Well, for Jewish people in that day, which Jesus and Peter and all of those followers were, all of them would have identified the Messiah or the Christ with an anointed king. A royal figure that's coming from the line of David, that's expected to free Israel from Gentile oppressors and purify the people and restore Israel's independence. Like, that was the expectation. So to call Jesus the Messiah, that's who you're saying Jesus is. It seems that Peter was thinking of this kind of Messiah when he claims that Jesus is the Christ. And he used the right formula, but his understanding of what he was saying could not have been farther from the truth. So then Jesus immediately teaches the disciples to rethink their expectation for the Messiah. He wants them to go from the Messiah as a military king who overthrows oppressors by force to set people free, to a Messiah who will suffer and be put to death by the powers, only to rise again. The reorienting of the disciples' understanding of the Messiah, this is the tipping point in Mark's gospel. Up until this moment, and it happens right in the middle of Mark's gospel, up until this moment, the first 7+ chapters of Mark, we have Jesus being baptized, going into the wilderness, healing, teaching. He's starting to understand a little more clearly his own identity, who he is and whose he is. From this point forward, everything shifts. At this tipping point, we start to move with Jesus and his followers toward Jerusalem and an intense, intense provocation between Jesus and the powers that be in his time. So to be clear, a suffering Messiah is not who Peter and the others had signed up to follow. And having experienced this tipping point regarding what it means to confess Jesus as the Messiah, the disciples learn that following Jesus is not going to lead where they had been imagining. As soon as Peter says Jesus is the Messiah, immediately we move from that confession to don't tell anyone about it to this is what it means for your life. So first, following Jesus is going to require from them to deny oneself, to take up the cross. Following Jesus means removing ourselves from consideration regarding how we're going to be in the world. Following Jesus means being willing to put our lives on line for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of our neighbor. And second, those who want to save their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for Jesus' sake will find it. It's this paradox, this contradiction that we're called to live into. And there's a New Testament scholar in D.C., and her name is Sharon Ring, and she says it this way. The disciples are indeed called to be prepared to share in the fate of the one they follow and to recognize that it is there that true life is found. It's in that following, placing our life in line with Jesus's in that way, that we actually find life. So it's not enough to confess Jesus as Messiah. The confession is compelled to and tied with a whole way of life. We can't just say the formula. We have to embody the way. Understanding the true meaning of Christ and being called to a particular way of life, what we call discipleship, those in the Christian world are tied together. And so there is a Croatian theologian who teaches at Yale, and he himself is a refugee. He teaches now, and he writes about this. His name is Miroslav Volf, and he writes brilliantly. And so I want to share some of his words. He says, all sufferers can find comfort in the solidarity of the crucified. But only those who struggle against evil by following the example of the crucified will discover him at their side. To claim the comfort of the crucified while rejecting his way is to advocate not only cheap grace, but a deceitful ideology. So in other words, if you get the formula correct, but your life doesn't embody it, miss. That's when Jesus gets really upset about what's going on. That's the tipping point in the gospel. Wolf continues, in a world of violence, the cross, the eminently countercultural symbol that lives at the heart of the Christian faith, is a scandal, he says. There is no genuinely Christian way around the scandal. In the final analysis, the only available options are either reject the cross, and with it, the core of Christian faith, or take up one's cross, follow the crucified, and be scandalized ever anew by the challenge. So, in other words, it's not just a tipping point in the middle of Mark's gospel, but it needs to be a tipping point in our lives, in whatever moment we're in right now. So when Peter first calls Jesus in Mark 8 the Messiah, he is not understanding the words that he's saying out loud. He hasn't yet experienced the tipping point in his own way of seeing Jesus. It's as though he's getting ready to enter godly play for the very first time. He's being asked if he's ready. He's saying yes, and he has no idea what is actually to come. Peter's hope is not in the scandal of Christian faith, but in a God that he believes will be powerful and will rise up in an expected way to overthrow a government and a regime. It's like a child going into godly play, assuming that the teachers will give all the answers, that the child's work will just be to learn a formula and be done. Miroslav Volf calls that thin faith. Thin faith. And before Volf, Dietrich Bonhoeffer called that cheap grace. So thin faith and cheap grace is what happens when we reduce faith and discipleship to a formula and check it off. Jesus leads his followers in Mark 8 beyond thin faith to what Volf calls thick faith, from cheap grace to costly discipleship. Mark 8 is a tipping point in the way Jesus calls his followers to understand the meaning of him as Christ, and consequently, and tied together, what it means then for them to follow Jesus. To find their lives, they need to lose them. While thin faith and cheap grace separate our Christology, the way we think about Jesus, from our ecclesiology or the way we become church, thick faith and costly discipleship tie them together. We can't think about Jesus without embodying that in our daily lives. And when that happens, Jesus rebukes Peter, saying, "You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." So Jesus is calling him from cheap grace to costly discipleship. They're clashing over what it means to be the Messiah. And according to human conceptions of the Messiah, suffering should be conquered, not embraced. That's thin faith, cheap grace. That's the faith that led people to use the language of Christianity to justify apartheid, to rationalize slavery, to advance Jim Crow laws, or today to deny climate change. That's thin faith. But according to divine things, suffering and death are necessary to be God's anointed. And this is thick faith, costly discipleship. It's the faith that inspired abolitionists. It's the faith that sustained suffragettes and continues to embolden those that are on the front line of organizing for environmental justice. David Loess puts the issue before us like this. Notice how concretely, literally true these words turn out to be for Jesus as he does, in fact, lose his life and then find it. Or really, it's given back to him through the resurrection. He's losing his life and literally finding it. So the question, invites David Loess, might be this. Might this also be literally, concretely true for us? That is, in what ways have we also experienced losing our life as the key to receiving it back? So what I wonder this morning, maybe 250 or so people are going to gather here for worship here at the table this morning. I wonder what it would look like if some of us experienced a tipping point this morning. Maybe not all of us, but just a few of us. A tipping point that called us to lose our lives in the coming week for the sake of the gospel, for our neighbors. I wonder how different a couple homes might be, and then how that difference might then make a difference in the whole neighborhood, and in the community, and in the city, and at what point might that tip toward a movement that the whole world is being realigned. See, a preschooler was welcomed across the threshold of their new godly play sanctuary for the very first time this morning. And today might just be a tipping point in that child's life, in the way they see God, in the way they see the world, in the way they see themselves. And thin faith would have parents say, "Well, we're here because I want my child to go to Sunday school." Thin faith would say, "I want to be here because the formula is I go to church and that equals being good." That's thin faith. And it guides a lot of us a lot of the time. But like Peter, those of us with thin faith miss the depth and the challenge that's right before us while we watch our little 4 and 5-year-old journey toward that godly playroom. See, thick faith, costly discipleship, will remind the parents among us that we're losing a little bit of ourselves as our child goes across that threshold, because it's not really about us. Thick faith might compel not just the parents, but all of us in this community to accompany those young friends as they wonder about our tradition. not just the parent responsibility, but the whole community that has something at stake as we try to accompany these children. See, some of us will have to die. We'll have to die or lose some of our understandings of parenting, our understandings of community, our understandings of God. We'll literally have to lose the scripts that we've been following, that we've come unconsciously to trust. And my prayer is that by losing these parts of ourselves for the sake of the gospel, that we'll actually find life. The life that God longs for us to experience. So may today be a tipping point in which we surrender our thin faith and find our way together into God's costly discipleship. Amen.
To Jesus I surrender. Lord, I give myself to thee. Fill me with thy love and power. Let thy blessing fall.